It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Deal or No Deal, can negotiators from Iran and the so-called P5 plus one group that includes the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany reach a comprehensive accord which would block Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Monday, November 24th, is the deadline for the P5 plus one to reach agreement with Iran to curb its uranium enrichment. In exchange, Western sanctions on Iran would be lifted. Negotiations had been sputtering along for almost a decade, but took on a new life last year after a so-called moderate, Hassan Rouhani, was elected president of Iran. He promised to rid the country of bruising sanctions that have sent the economy into a tailspin, which has been compounded by plummeting oil prices. An interim agreement last November called for Iran to curb its most sensitive nuclear activity while receiving targeted sanction relief. The deadline for a wider deal was originally set for July, but with no agreement in place, negotiators decided to continue the process for another 6 months. The best-case scenario is that both camps agree to keep talking. Three broad sticking points have emerged. The six negotiating partners, primarily the United States, want Iran to slash its 19,000 uranium-enriching centrifuges to levels low enough that monitors would notice if Iran cheated and tried to make a nuclear bomb. Iran says its nuclear industry is for civilian energy production and medicine and has balked at cuts. In addition, skeptics in the United States and elsewhere want to know whether Iran once had a nuclear weapons program and if it is ongoing. But Iran has not provided enough access or information for the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to conclusively rule on a possible military dimension to Iran's program. Finally, for its part, Iran appears to be insisting on a rapid lifting of all sanctions. American and European diplomats want the measures to be removed gradually after Iran shows it's cooperating. And the United States Congress is one of the wild cards in any delay. Many Republican and Democratic members believe that sanctions have helped nudge Iran to the negotiating table and that they are being eroded by an administration eager for a legacy-building deal. Some already are talking about imposing more sanctions as leverage to make Iran more transparent and cooperative with IAEA monitors. Well, for more on prospects of reaching a nuclear deal with Iran and the fallout of failure, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Emanuele Ottolenghi is a political scientist, author, and senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Alex Vatanka, he's senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, also a policy group based here in Washington. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Gentlemen, let's talk about this deal or no deal, Emanuele Ottolenghi. How close are we? Do you think some deal can be reached, or might there be an agreement to extend the talks?
It's hard to tell how close we are. Much of what is happening now as we speak in Vienna could be theater, brinkmanship for last-minute details, or what we hear in the news report might be real enough, and there are significant gaps. The impression that everybody seems to have in the policy circles, certainly here in Washington, is that by now, with very little time left until the Monday deadline, it appears that the likelihood of the last gaps being bridged is low. And the question is raised, what happens if by Monday night, at the turn of midnight, Iran and the six world powers have failed to bridge those gaps? Again, the common opinion seems to be that there should be an extension of the interim deal, because the administration here in Washington, certainly, and to a large extent the Europeans as well in the past few months, have peddled the notion that the alternative to a deal is war. Now, there is nothing further from the truth than that. The best outcome to these talks, in my view, is that if there is no good deal on Monday, there should be no deal, and the interim agreement should be let to expire. Because we are actually not just 1 year minus a few hours into the interim agreement's negotiations. We are 12 years into negotiations. And the truth is that we have been here before where talks have broken down, where disagreements have led to negotiators to walk away, where partial deals such as the uranium swap deal of 2009 seemed to be a way forward and then they collapsed. And the truth of the matter is eventually both sides need to come back, and they do. They come back and talk again. If you extend 4 more months, which may turn into 8 months or another year or another 2 years, you're basically back into the situation of the past 12 years, but without the ability of the West to dial up sanctions and increase economic leverage if there is no agreement on Iran's part. So I think that the best option now, if there is no good deal on Monday, is let the JPOA expire, and within a few months, there will be negotiations again, but the U.S. and its European allies will be in a position, if they want to increase economic pressure on Iran in order to improve their leverage, which 1 year of sanctions relief has significantly eroded.
Turning to you, Alex Vetanka, to comment. I know you're following closely what's going on in Iran. Do you agree that we've been here before? Is there no difference in the fact that a more moderate president, Hassan Rouhani, is in power, notwithstanding the fact that Ayatollah Khamenei basically runs the nuclear file? How do you see what may happen on Monday? And do you think also that it should expire, as Emanuele Ottolenghi said, if in fact no deal is reached? Or do you see a positive outcome in a potential extension?
Looking at the debate in Tehran, listening to the moderates and the hardliners, the president, I haven't, in the last 15 years where I've been covering Iran daily, ever seen such consensus on the issue of the need for the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States to talk. And it's sort of underwritten by the top man in the Iranian system, the Supreme Leader himself. Now, we can debate why he decided to negotiate with the United States. I, for one, don't think he woke up one morning and decided, you know, I love America now, so let's put all the bad blood behind us. That's not why he got to the table of negotiations. He got there because Iran's been bleeding, and bleeding badly, and the question of the regime's survival is at stake. So I think we've got to be mature enough to not assume, and this is some sort of a major ideological shift on the part of the hardliners in Iran for why they've come to the table. In terms of whether a deal will happen on Monday or not, what should come after, it's very difficult to say if a deal will happen or not. But I think the most likely scenario is you're going to have an extension. To Emmanuel's point about should you have this track collapse, you sort of leave it at that for a few months. There's some things to be said about it, but basically you're going to end up negotiating. And you could perhaps, as you extend these talks, if that's what it takes, you can make changes to the existing track. Why have a lapse of a few months? I mean, why not just change the contract? The interim agreement can be changed, presumably, and if the Iranians are willing to do that. But what is true, though, is that on the Iranian side, they have no way but to continue the talks. I don't think they have an alternative. I don't think even the hardliners have an alternative. And on the United States side, we have people who are obviously very skeptical of what President Obama is doing. But frankly, I have yet to see a credible alternative to the diplomatic track. Now, again, I agree with Emmanuel. I don't think there is any real sign of this country going to war with Iran anytime soon over this issue. But I don't see the sort of let Iran just linger and that issue linger and let everybody else in the Middle East figure it out for themselves. Well, we have the potential for proliferation of arms race. That doesn't do United States national security any good either. So I think realistically, if there's no deal by Monday, they're going to have an extension. And, you know, if it takes some adjustments, so be it. But ultimately, there's no alternative but to continue talking.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Emanuele Ottolenghi, he's senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Alex Vetanka, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. We're discussing prospects for a peaceful resolution to Iran's nuclear program as we move closer to the November 24th deadline. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, and we want to hear from you. Please connect with us on Facebook or send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. And this week we want to offer a warm welcome to our new Facebook fans from Nigeria, Ghana, and Kenya. Thanks so much for your support. Well, back to you, Emmanuel Otulenghi. And of course, there's a lot of politics that we cannot avoid, both on the Iranian and the United States side in particular. And let's take a look at that because we just had elections here. We'll have a new Republican-controlled Congress in January. There's going to be a lot of talk about increasing sanctions. And this is almost bipartisan. There are both Republicans and Democrats who would like to actually ratchet up the sanctions on Iran if perhaps this deal cannot be reached. What is your take on increasing sanctions? Some argue that they could act as leverage to make Iran more transparent and cooperative.
Well, Alex just made the best case possible for sanctions. He said that Iran really has no choice but to talk. Sanctions brought Iran to its knees economically, and that's what pretty much everybody agrees is what convinced its regime to return to the table and to negotiate in a way that was certainly different from what we got accustomed to under the 8 years of President Ahmadinejad. Now, the decision by the P5+1 to sign an interim agreement was predicated on the fact that, yes, there was a risk in offering sanctions relief to Iran. But we would test that risk by negotiating for 12 months. And if in 12 months, that's what the agreement clearly states, if in 12 months there is no agreement, there is no extension. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't talk some more. The point is that that framework whereby the West relaxes sanctions and does not impose new one expires. So because it looks like we are not going to get an agreement, and part of the reason why we're not going to get an agreement is because the Supreme Leader has put clear red lines on the nuclear program, and those red lines essentially say we agree to a number of adjustments, but we will not give up the nuclear industrial infrastructure we built in the last 3 decades, which can be used in the future to build nuclear weapons. If you can't get Iran to agree to dismantle that infrastructure, if you can't agree to Iran to abide by its international obligations, which Iran has consistently violated, if you can't get Iran to agree to be transparent about its past activities, including the possible military dimensions that the UN agency watchdog, the IAEA, is so concerned about, then there should be no agreement on Monday. The deal should be let to expire, and the P5+1 should continue to negotiate with the restoring of sanctions as a pressure tool vis-a-vis Iran.
Okay, so you do agree that more sanctions should be discussed?
If there is no agreement on Monday, then more sanctions should be on the table to force Iran to agree to what Iran can't agree now.
Okay, but Alex Vatanka, here's the other side. Some say that more sanctions by Congress could push the Iranians actually to give up on the talks and even aggravate other important allies of the United States in the P5+1 who are playing along with these sanctions against Iran. So where do you stand? Should we not reach an agreement? Would more sanctions be helpful or would they be harmful in getting Iran to become more transparent and cooperative?
I mean, this is a great unknown that I can't really speak to because I'm not privy to the negotiations. But if we ever found out what resulted in the collapse of the talks, hence we didn't get a deal in Vienna, then we can start distributing blame. But to Emmanuel's point, if we go back and make the point that we want the dismantlement of the Iranian industrial nuclear cycle, that's not what the interim agreement was about. It's not about dismantling the entire program. And I think that's totally unrealistic to expect that. We can reverse that. And I think, never mind Ayatollah Khamenei, I think even if we had regime change in Iran, it's very hard at the moment to envisage any Iranian leader to come in and wanted to sort of say, we're going to take all this out of the equation. I just don't see that happening. So what that leaves us with is exactly what the interim agreement is about. How do you provide the sufficient assurances that you're going to stick to a civilian nuclear program, that you're going to give us all the access we need to make sure you don't go and ask for a weapon? In that sense, I think a resolution can be had. But if you turn it around and say we want a dismantlement, we want Iran to have no nuclear capacity, then I agree with you. Then there's no point to the talks. But that's not what the interim agreement of 2013 was about. Look, in terms of the U.S. Congress, the thing that has happened in the 12 years that the Iranian nuclear program came to light is the so-called new Cold War. You have Russia right now picking up fights with the West over certain issues that, you know, we wouldn't have predicted a few months ago even. it's difficult to see how the United States can continue to keep the momentum and the coalition that has very successfully been put together and kept together for a number of years against the Iranian nuclear program. The biggest untold story of the campaign against Iran's nuclear program is how successfully the international campaign led by the P5 plus Germany has stayed together. We're in danger of maybe losing that, particularly if the United States is seen to be suddenly changing its position on what Iran ought to do on the nuclear program. If the Russians and Chinese feel that the U.S. is changing the game plan, and if they walk away from more international sanctions, that's what the Iranian hardliners would love to see. Because they have been waiting for this for a long time, the crumbling of the international consensus. And you know what? They couldn't care less about unilateral American sanctions. They've lived with that for decades. So they can probably learn to live with that again. What they worry is the UN and the world community speaking with one voice, as it has for a number of years. That's what they love to see go away.
Well, that's a well-taken point, and that's what I was getting at, Emanuele Ottolenghi. Notwithstanding your points, it's keeping this important coalition together. But let me go back to you and talk about Iran's rise in the region vis-a-vis the fight against ISIL, ISIL, also known as the Islamic State. It appears that the United States and Iran, at least on the surface, have the same goal to obviously degrade ISIL. If we go back, we can probably blame Iran partially for helping to foster the rise of ISIL insofar as it supports the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, which obviously helped to incentivize the growth of ISIL both in Syria and now in Iraq. But what about the rise of Iran? And can we compartmentalize this nuclear file, you know, separate it from Iran's backing of terrorist groups like Hezbollah, which is obviously backing Bashar al-Assad, etc.?
To say that the United States and Iran have suddenly some shared interests, a bit like saying that the fish in the sea and the fishermen on the surface of the sea have a shared interest in keeping the sea from going dry. It's true. The fisherman needs the sea to float and fish the fish, and the fish needs the sea to survive. So they have a common interest. But they're not friends, because the fisherman is after the fish. Iran and the United States have opposing interests in the region. There is a tactical convergence on the Islamic State, which is temporary and largely tactical. It is a mistake to assume that we have to make concessions to Iran in order to get Iran to work with us against the Islamic State. They will care about their national interest and what threatens them, regardless of whether America is a friend or a foe. Now, the problem, I think, that we should discuss a little further is that the administration has somehow created the impression that if we could only push the nuclear issue aside or solve it, a whole new era of relations could rise where, you know, Iran would become, if not our friend overnight, certainly a partner on a number of files. So suddenly, the nuclear file has become the key to unlock every other problem. And this is pushing the United States to a strategic shift based on wishful thinking, not based on what Iran really says it wants and it believes, and not based on Iranian action, but based on the hope that by giving them an olive branch and offering them a way out of the nuclear impasse, we are going to strengthen some supposed moderate faction inside the Iranian regime who will then become our friend. Iran has come to these negotiations because it had its back against the wall. And by conducting the negotiations the way we have allowed Iran to get off the hook. And Iran has made it clear, and it's making it clear, especially in its behavior in support of the Syrian regime, that its outlook in the region hasn't changed, its ambitions in the region haven't changed, its confrontation with the United States and its allies have not changed dynamic. And so I think that we should be a lot more cautious about hoping and assuming that just because the regime has had a facelift since the election of June 2013 when Hassan Rouhani became president, Iran suddenly has become Finland.
Turning back to you, Alex Vetanko, obviously I'd like to get your view with respect to this issue. Emanuele Ottolenghi talked about the nuclear fire being potentially a key that could unlock other problems and perhaps open up better relations. I assume the United States would like to see that occur. But talk about Iran's rise in the region and the relationship between that and its nefarious activities, whether it's supporting Assad regime and Hezbollah. What is the relationship between that and its negotiations on the nuclear issue?
The big fear in the region, particularly among Iran's Arab neighbors to the south in places like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the big fear is that there's some sort of a compromise made between the United States and Iran over their heads, that they will have to indirectly kind of be learning to live with an Iran that is going to interfere more in their affairs than he has done in previous years. That is a very deep sense of fear they have. And you can trace its origins back to 1979, the rhetoric that came out of the mouth of Ayatollah Khomeini, founder, who was, you know, speaking openly about it, exporting their revolutions. And it doesn't really help Iran's case when it wants to, as Rouhani puts it, wants to come back to the international mainstream. Well, he says that, but then there are hardline commanders in the Revolutionary Guards who boast about how now Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, has fallen to Iran. Damascus fell, Beirut fell, Baghdad fell. That is something that ties to what Emmanuel was speaking about before, which is the vision inconsistency as far as the Iranian regime is concerned. There are different voices that speak about what Iran's role in the region on the international scene should be, and they don't always speak with the same voice. Now, there are people in Washington who think this whole thing is theater, that Rouhani and Zarif are basically playing a role. I don't subscribe to that. I think it's deeper than that. I really think there are genuine differences within the Iranian regime. There are Iranians who looked around and suddenly look at America and the threat that America has posed to them very differently today after the Islamic State is out there in Iraq and Syria beheading Shias just simply because they're Shias. Their threat perceptions have changed over the last few years. The sanctions certainly pushed them forward in terms of coming to the table, but I bet you if things continue, the violence in the region becomes more of a religious war than it is today, they even have to start questioning some of the wisdom behind their extreme animosity towards the state of Israel. Because in the scheme of things, that doesn't make sense either. Again, Iranians are, some of them, quietly raising even that issue. And the extremist Salafist threat isn't just a threat to Iran, isn't just a threat to the United States. It's also going to be a threat to Israel and others in the long term. But I agree with Emmanuel. What's happening in Iraq is tactical.
Does Iran, do the people you speak to, do they see their backing of Bashar al-Assad, who is anathema to the predominantly Sunni opposition? And we know that, I'm not going to go into history, but the opposition was very peaceful. Bashar al-Assad turned on his own people, did not want to compromise. The majority of the opposition that were protesting happened to be Sunni, and they're the majority in the country. And Bashar al-Assad is Alawite, an offshoot of Shia Islam, and he is a major benefactor of Iran. Does Iran see their backing of Bashar al-Assad and the way he has cracked down on innocent civilians? Do they see the relationship between that and the growth of some of these Sunni extremist groups like the so-called Islamic State?
You know,
that their backing is actually perpetuating the so-called caliphate that the Islamic State wants to create between Syria and Iraq and other places in the Levant?
I can only assume they are paying attention to that. I mean, Iran in 2006 used to be pretty popular in the Arab world, but today its image is totally destroyed. And I remember following events in Syria in summer of 2011. A few months after the uprising began, there were Iranians in Iranian state media raising the issue of, what are we doing here? That was an interesting debate to follow because they could see that what they were doing in terms of supporting Assad was directly tied to how many Syrians were getting killed by Assad's armed forces. By end of 2011, Iran just simply looked at Syria as a geopolitical game against the Saudis, and they were all in because that's their big regional rival, and unfortunately that's where we are. They have basically looked at it too far as a geopolitical issue and not from a moral standpoint.
Got it. Emanuele, for the last question, one more opportunity for you to discuss what we're likely to see in the next months. And the fact that the majority of Iranians, the young people, it's a huge population of young people who are very pro-American, the possibility of coming to an arrangement to contain Iran on the nuclear file so that it does not obtain a nuclear weapon, wouldn't this be a positive thing for U.S.-Iranian as well as Iranian international relations.
An agreement that deprives Iran of the instruments to obtain a nuclear weapon is something that we should hope for and welcome. In my view and assessment, and I may be proven wrong in coming hours, is that that agreement is not in the card. Now, even if that agreement is reached, it is unlikely that an agreement by itself will solve all of the other points of tension that the West has with Iran. And I am doubtful that the agreement can in some ways open up Iran to the kind of peaceful, gradual liberalization and change we would like. The agreement will give the regime legitimacy. It will prove to the population that the regime is there to stay. If the regime was feeling fragile as a result of economic pressure, the easing of sanctions will restore the economy and give the regime more strength.
But what about intrusive inspections and so on?
We will have to see whether an agreement is there that contains the tools to enable the international community to ensure that Iran is compliant with its international obligation. And the experience of the past 3 decades teaches that these tools are not perfect, and Iran has learned very well the art of cheating the international community on the nuclear program.
Let me turn to Alex Vatanko for really the last word on this whole issue. And do you think there is a catch-22 if there's a deal reached? This is a victory for the Islamic Republic, for the current regime. They'll see it as bolstering their power and perhaps not have an incentive to make fundamental changes.
I wouldn't be viewed to be defending the Islamic Republic of Iran. 28 years ago, I was forced to flee Iran because of the policies of the regime. I've seen firsthand what these people are capable of doing. All I think we need to admit to ourselves is the fact that this, as again, Emmanuel mentioned, extremely nationalist country and a nuclear issue. And we're sort of shifting the debate here. But if we are about regime change and not behavior in Iran's nuclear activities, but if we are about regime change, the nuclear issue is probably one of the worst instruments we can come up with to mobilize an otherwise angry Iranian population against their own regime. Because the regime will very cleverly, as they've done in the past, turn the country around, wrap themselves in the Iranian national flag as the defenders of the country. We need to be much smarter about the issues we adopt as ways to highlighting the major policy shortcomings of this regime. But I think we got to perhaps go back and look at what is it we're set out to do here. If it's nuclear program in Iran that the world will learn to live with, then there are ways to perhaps go about it. More inspection, more cameras, this and the other. The list is long. But if we are talking about bringing about the downfall of the Islamic Republic, which, you know, a lot of people can make very many arguments for, and I would be one of them, but I don't think the nuclear issue is the instrument to do that. Nor do I think that's what the agreement of 2013 and these talks are all about. It's a separate issue. So I think we should be careful not to sort of conflict the two.
All right. Well, certainly the Voice of America will bring you the latest on all these important talks between Iran and the P5+1 as they unfold. For now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Emanuele Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Alex Vatanko, Senior Fellow at the Middle East Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Sidrak Franklin, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.